Chapter 7, Rembrandt and the Father. While I was sitting in front of the painting in the Hermitage, trying to absorb what I saw, many groups of tourists passed by. Even though they spent less than a minute with the painting, almost all of the guides described it as a painting of the Compassionate Father, and most of them mentioned that it was one of Rembrandt's last paintings, one to which he came only after a life of suffering. Indeed, this is what the painting is all about. It is the human expression of divine compassion. Instead of being called The Return of the Prodigal Son, it could easily have been called The Welcome by the Compassionate Father. The emphasis is less on the son than on the father. The parable is in truth a parable of the father's love. Looking at the way in which Rembrandt portrays the father, there came to me a whole new interior understanding of tenderness, mercy, and forgiveness. Seldom, if ever, has God's immense, compassionate love been expressed in such a poignant way. Every detail of the father's figure, his facial expression, his posture, the colors of his dress, and most of all, the still gesture of his hands, speaks of the divine love for humanity that existed from the beginning and ever will be. Everything comes together here. Rembrandt's story, humanity's story, and God's story. Time and eternity intersect. Approaching death and everlasting life touch each other. Sin and forgiveness embrace. The human and the divine become one. What gives Rembrandt's portrayal of the Father such an irresistible power is that the most divine is captured in the most human. I see a half-blind old man with a mustache and a parted beard, dressed in a gold-embroidered garment and a deep red cloak, laying his large, stiffened hands on the shoulder of his returning son. This is very specific, concrete, and describable. I also see, however, infinite compassion, unconditional love, everlasting forgiveness, divine realities, emanating from a father who is the creator of the universe. Here, both the human and the divine, the fragile and the powerful, the old and the eternally young are fully expressed. This is Rembrandt's genius. The spiritual truth is completely enfleshed. As Paul Bondaquit writes, the spiritual in Rembrandt pulls its strongest and most splendid accents from the flesh. It is of special significance that Rembrandt chose a nearly blind old man to communicate God's love. Surely the parable Jesus told and the way the parable has been interpreted throughout the centuries offer the main basis for the portrayal of God's merciful love. But I should not forget that it was Rembrandt's own story that enabled him to give it its unique expression. Paul Bondaquit says, since his youth, Rembrandt has always but one vocation, to grow old. And it is true that Rembrandt always displayed a great interest in older people. He had drawn them, etched them, and painted them ever since he was a young man and became increasingly fascinated by their inner beauty. Some of Rembrandt's most stunning portraits are of old people, and his most gripping self-portraits are made during his last years. After many trials at home and at work, he shows a special fascination with blind people. As the light in his work interiorizes, he begins to paint blind people as the real seers. He is attracted to Tobit and the near-blind Simeon, and he paints them several times. As Rembrandt's own life moves towards the shadows of old age, as success wanes and the exterior splendor of his life diminishes, he comes more in touch with the immense beauty of the interior life. There he discovers the light that comes from an inner fire that never dies, the fire of love. His art no longer tries to grasp, conquer, and regulate the visible, but to transform the visible in the fire of love that comes from the unique heart of the artist. The unique heart of Rembrandt becomes the unique heart of the Father. The inner light-giving fire of love that has grown strong through the artist's many years of suffering burns in the heart of the Father who welcomes his returning son. I understand now why Rembrandt didn't follow the literal text of the parable. There, St. Luke writes, while the younger son was still a long way off, his father saw him and was moved with pity. He ran to the boy, clasped him in his arms, and kissed him. Earlier in his life, Rembrandt had etched and drawn this event with all the dramatic movement it contains. But as he approached death, Rembrandt chose to portray a very still father who recognized his son not with the eyes of the body, but with the inner eye of his heart. It seems that the hands that touch the back of the returning son are the instruments of the father's inner eye. The near-blind father sees far and wide. His seeing is an eternal seeing, a seeing that reaches out to all of humanity. It is a seeing that understands the lostness of women and men of all times and places, that knows with immense compassion the suffering of those who have chosen to leave home, the cry to oceans of tears as they get caught in anguish and agony. The heart of the father burns with an immense desire to bring his children home. Oh, how much he would have liked to talk to them, to warn them about the many dangers they were facing, and to convince them at home that at home could be found everything that they searched for elsewhere. How much would he have liked to pull them back with his fatherly authority and hold them close to himself so that they would not get hurt? But his love is too great to do any of that. It cannot force, constrain, push, or pull. It offers the freedom to reject that love or to love in return. It is precisely the immensity of the divine love that is the source of the divine suffering. God, creator of heaven and earth, has chosen to be first and foremost a father. As father, he wants his children to be free, free to love. That freedom includes the possibility of their leaving home, going to a distant country, and losing everything. The father's heart knows all the pain that will come from that choice, but his love makes him powerless to prevent it. As father, he desires that those who stay at home enjoy his presence and experience his affection. But here again, he wants only to offer a love that can be freely received. He suffers beyond telling when his children honor him only with lip service, while their hearts are far from him. He knows their deceitful tongues and disloyal hearts, but he cannot make them love him without losing his true fatherhood. As father, the only authority he claims for himself is the authority of compassion. That authority comes from letting the sins of his children pierce his heart. There is no lust, greed, anger, resentment, jealousy, or vengeance in his lost children that has not caused immense grief to his heart. The grief is so deep because the heart is so pure. From the deep inner place where love embraces all human grief, the father reaches out to his children. The touch of his hands, radiating inner light, seeks only to heal. Here's the God I want to believe in. A father who from the beginning of creation has stretched out his arms in merciful blessing, never forcing himself on anyone, but always waiting. Never letting his arms drop down in despair, but always hoping that his children will return so that he can speak words of love to them and let his tired arms rest on their shoulders. His only desire is to bless. In Latin, to bless is benedicere, which means literally saying good things. The father wants to say, more with his touch than with his voice, good things of his children. He has no desire to punish them. They've already been punished excessively by their own inner or outer waywardness. The father wants simply to let them know that the love they have searched for in such distorted ways has been, is, and always will be there for them. The father wants to say, more with his hands than with his mouth, "You are my beloved. On you my favor rests." He is the shepherd, feeding his flock, gathering lambs in his arms, holding them against his breast. The true center of Rembrandt's painting is the hands of the father. On them, all the light is concentrated. On them, the eyes of the bystanders are focused. In them, mercy becomes flesh. Upon them, forgiveness, reconciliation, and healing come together. And through them, not only the tired son, but also the worn-out father find their rest. From the moment I first saw the poster on Simone's office door, I felt drawn to those hands. I did not fully understand why. But gradually over the years, I have come to know those hands. They have held me from the hour of my conception. They welcomed me at my birth, held me close to my mother's breast, fed me and kept me warm. They've protected me in times of danger and consoled me in times of grief. They've waved me goodbye and also welcomed me back. Those hands are God's hands. They are also the hands of my parents, teachers, friends, healers, and all those of whom God has given me to remind me how safely I am held. Not long after Rembrandt painted the father in his blessing's hands, he died. Rembrandt's hands had painted countless human faces and human hands. In this, one of the last paintings, he painted the face and the hands of God. Who had posed for the life-size portrait of God? Rembrandt himself. The father of the prodigal son is a self-portrait, but not in the traditional sense. Rembrandt's own face appears in several of his paintings. It appears as the prodigal son in the brothel, as a frightened disciple on the lake, as one of the men taking the dead body of Jesus from the cross. Yet here it is not Rembrandt's face that is reflected, but his soul, the soul of a father who had suffered so many a death. During his 63 years, Rembrandt not only saw his dear wife Saskia die, but also three sons, two daughters, and the two women with whom he lived. The grief for his beloved son Titus, who died at the age of 26 shortly after his marriage, has never been described. But in the father of the prodigal son, we can see how many tears it must have cost him. Created in the image of God, Rembrandt had come to discover, through his long, painful struggle, the true nature of that image. It is the image of a near-blind old man, crying tenderly, blessing his deeply wounded son. Rembrandt was the son. He became the father, and thus was made ready to enter eternal life. Chapter 8, The Father Welcomes Home. Often, I have asked friends to give me their first impression of Rembrandt's prodigal son. Inevitably, they point to the wise man who forgives his son, the benevolent patriarch. The longer I looked at the patriarch, the clearer it became to me that Rembrandt had done something quite different from letting God pose as the wise old head of a family. It all began with the hands. The two are quite different. The father's left hand touching his son's shoulder is strong and muscular. The fingers are spread out and cover a large part of the prodigal son's shoulder and back. I can see a certain pressure, especially in the thumb. That hand seems not only to touch, but with its great strength, also to hold. Even though there is a gentleness in the way of the father's left hand touches his son, it is not without a firm grip. How different is the father's right hand? The hand is not hold or grasped. It is refined, soft, and very tender. The fingers are close to each other, and they have an elegant quality. It lies gently upon the son's shoulder. It wants to caress, to stroke, and to offer consolation and comfort. It is a mother's hand. Some commentators have suggested that the masculine left hand is Rembrandt's own hand, while the feminine right hand is similar to the right hand of the Jewish bride painted in the same period. I like to believe that that is true. As soon as I recognized the difference between the two hands of the father, a new world of meaning opened up for me. The father is not simply a great patriarch. He is mother as well as father. He touches the son with a masculine hand and a feminine hand. He holds and she caresses. He confirms and she consoles. He is indeed God, in whom both manhood and womanhood, fatherhood and motherhood are fully present. That gentle caressing right hand echoes for me the words of the prophet Isaiah. Can a woman forget her baby at the breast, feel no pity for the child she has born? Even if they were to forget, I shall not forget you. Look, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands. My friend Richard White pointed out to me that the caressing feminine hand of the father parallels the bare wounded foot of the son, while the strong masculine hand parallels the foot dressed in a sandal. Is it too much to think that the one hand protects the vulnerable side of the son, while the other hand reinforces the son's strength and desire to get on with his life? Then there is the great red cloak. With its warm color and its arch-like shape, it offers a welcome place where it is good to be. At first, the cloak covering the bent-over body of the father looked to me like a tent, inviting the tired traveler to find some rest. But as I went on gazing at the red cloak, another image, stronger than that of a tent, came to me. The sheltering wings of the mother bird. They reminded me of Jesus' words about the maternal love. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often have I longed to gather your children, as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you refused. Day and night, God holds me safe, as a hen holds her chicks secure under her wings. Even more than that of a tent, the image of a vigilant mother bird's wings expresses the safety that God offers her children. They express care, protection, a place to find rest and feel safe. Every time I look at the tent-like and wings-like cloak in Rembrandt's painting, I sense the motherly quality of God's love, and my heart begins to sing in the words inspired by the psalmist. You who dwell in the shelter of the Most High and abide in the shade of the Almighty, say to your God, my refuge, my stronghold, my God in whom I trust. You conceal me with your pinions, and under your wings I shall find refuge. And so, under the aspect of an old Jewish patriarch, there emerges also a motherly God receiving her son home. As I now look again at Rembrandt's old man bending over his returning son and touching his shoulders with his hands, I begin to see not only a father who clasped his son in his arms, but also a mother who caresses her child, surrounds him with the warmth of her body, and holds him against the womb from which he sprang. Thus, the return of the prodigal son becomes the return to God's womb, the return to the very origins of being, and again echoes Jesus' exhortation to Nicodemus to be reborn from above. Now I understand better also the enormous stillness of this portrait of God. There's no sentimentality here, no romanticism, no simplistic tale with a happy ending. What I see here is God as mother, receiving back into her womb the one whom she made in her own image. The near-blind eyes, the hand, the cloak, the bent-over body, they all call forth the divine maternal love, sparked by grief, desire, hope, and endless waiting. The mystery, indeed, is that God, in her infinite compassion, has linked herself for eternity with the life of her children. She has freely chosen to become dependent on her creatures, whom she has gifted with freedom. This choice causes her grief when they leave. This choice brings her gladness when they return. But her joy will not be complete until all who have received life from her have returned home and gathered together around the table prepared for them. And this includes the elder son. Rembrandt places him at a distance, out from under the billowing cloak at the edge of the circle of light. The elder son's dilemma is to accept or reject that his father's love is beyond comparisons, to dare to be loved as his father longs to love him, or to insist on being loved as he feels he ought to be loved. The father knows the choice must be the son's, even while he waits with outstretched hands. Will the elder son be willing to kneel and be touched by the same hands that touch his younger brother? Will he be willing to be forgiven and to experience the healing presence of his father, who loves him beyond compare? Luke's story makes it very clear that the father goes out to both of his children. Not only does he run out to welcome the younger wayward son, but he comes out also to meet the elder dutiful son as he returns from the field, wondering what the music and dancing are all about, and urges him to come in. It is very important for me to understand the full meaning of what is happening here. While the father is truly filled with joy at his younger son's return, he has not forgotten the elder. He doesn't take his elder son for granted. His joy was so intense that he couldn't wait to start celebrating. But as soon as he became aware of his elder son's arrival, he left the party, went out to him, and pleaded with him to join him. In his jealousy and bitterness, the elder son can only see that his irresponsible brother is receiving more attention than he himself, and concludes that he is the less loved of the two. His father's heart, however, is not divided into more or less. The father's free and spontaneous response to his younger son's return does not involve any comparisons with his elder son. To the contrary, he ardently desires to make his elder son part of his joy. This is not easy for me to grasp. In a world that constantly compares people, ranking them as more or less intelligent, more or less attractive, more or less successful, it's not easy to really believe in a love that does not do the same. When I hear someone praised, it is hard not to think of myself as less praiseworthy. When I read about the goodness and kindness of other people, it is hard not to wonder whether I myself am as good, as kind as they are. And when I see trophies, rewards, and prizes being handed out to special people, I cannot avoid asking myself why they didn't happen to me. The world in which I have grown up is a world full of grades, scores, and statistics that consciously or unconsciously, I always try to take my measure against all the others. Much sadness and gladness in my life flow directly from my comparing. And most, if not all, of this comparing is useless and a terrible waste of time and energy. Our God, who is both a father and mother to us, does not compare. Never. Even though I know in my head that that is true, it still is very hard to fully accept it with my whole being. When I hear someone called a favorite son or daughter, my immediate response is that the other children must be less appreciated or less loved. I cannot fathom how all of God's children can be favorites, and still they are. When I look from my place in the world into God's kingdom, I quickly come to think of God as the keeper of some great celestial scoreboard, and I will always be afraid of not making the grade. But as soon as I look from God's welcoming home into the world, I discover that God loves with a divine love, a love that cedes to all women and men their uniqueness without ever comparing. The elder brother compares himself with the younger one and becomes jealous, but the father loves them both so much that it didn't even occur to him to delay the party in order to prevent the elder son from feeling rejected. I am convinced that many of my emotional problems would melt as snow in the sun if I would let the truth of God's motherly, non-comparing love permeate my heart. How hard that is becomes clear when I reflect on the parable of the laborers in the vineyard. Each time I read that parable, in which the landowner gives as much to the workers who worked only 1 hour as to those who did a heavy day's work in all the heat, a feeling of irritation still wells up in me. Why didn't the landowner pay those who worked many long hours first and then surprise the latecomers with his generosity? Why instead does he pay the workers of the 11th hour first, raising false expectations in others and creating unnecessary bitterness and jealousy? These questions, I now realize, come from a perspective that is too willing to impose the economy of the temporal on the unique order of the divine. It hadn't previously occurred to me that the landowner might have wanted the workers of the early hours to rejoice in his generosity to the latecomers. It never crossed my mind that he might have acted on the supposition that those who had worked in the vineyard the whole day would be deeply grateful to have had the opportunity to do work for their boss, and even more grateful to see what a generous man he is. It requires an interior about-face to accept such a non-comparing way of thinking. But that is God's way of thinking. God looks at his people as children of a family who are happy that those who have done only a little bit are as much loved as those who accomplish much. God is so naive as to think that there would be great rejoicing when all those who had spent time in his vineyard, whether a short time or a long time, were given the same attention. Indeed, he was so naive as to expect that they would all be so happy to be in his presence that comparing themselves with each other wouldn't even occur to them. That is why he says with the bewilderment of a misunderstood lover, "Why should you be envious because I am generous?" He could have said, "You have been with me the whole day, and I gave you all you asked for. Why are you so bitter?" It is the same bewilderment that comes from the heart of his father when he says to his jealous son, "My son, you are with me always, and all I have is yours." Here lies hidden the great call to conversion, to look not with the eyes of my own low self-esteem, but with the eyes of God's love. As long as I keep looking at God as a landowner, as a father who wants to get the most out of me for the least cost, I cannot but become jealous, bitter, and resentful toward my fellow workers or my brothers and sisters. But if I'm able to look at the world with the eyes of God's love and discover that God's vision is not that of a stereotypical landowner or patriarch, but rather that of an all-giving and forgiving father who does not measure out his love to his children according to how well they behave, then I quickly see that my only true response can be deep gratitude.